This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least three times a month, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 489, it's the first episode of 2026. We have the preview of the January 2026 edition of Retinal Physician. This was a great one, talking about new technologies, including new implementations of OCT angiography, wearables for patients, and also heads-up display. We ended the discussion of endogenous fungal endophthalmitis, a little niche topic I really enjoy. Thanks to Drs. Thomas and Zahid for joining for this one, and I hope you enjoy. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a preview of the January 2026 edition of Retinal Physician. We made it to 2026, kicking off the year in fashion, joined by two of my favorite friends, Dr. Akshay Thomas, who's in Nashville. Akshay, welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
And I have Dr. Sarwar Zahid from New York. Sarwar, welcome.
Thanks, Jay. Good to be back.
So let's jump right in. We got four articles. If people want to read them, you can go find them. They're on the website, retinalphysician.com. We're not going to summarize every detail. We're just going to discuss them. I'll give a quick summary of each one. So this first one, let's talk about OCTA. I know it feels like this is the 16th time we've talked about OCTA, but this time it's really important, I swear. OCTA in the retina clinic, which is Tim Lee with Sid Sheckett as the senior author. And again, they summarize how OCTA differs from OCT and essentially what it does in terms of the sequential B scan, seeing the movement of red blood cells, and how it allows visualization of all the vascular networks. When you scan, you avoid dye. It can be integrated into the retina clinic to look for neovascularization. It could be integrated with wide field OCTA to look for non-perfusion. They show some great examples of how you can see dropout in diabetics. And then they talk about what everyone's talked about for years, really since we were in fellowship and before we were in fellowship, the advantages and limitations. Of course, it's non-invasive. Of course, it's faster. There's no risk of anaphylaxis. However, the limitations is you need fixation to get the scans that you need. Much more prone to artifact than standard OCT, which is like magic. You don't really need much of a view sometimes to get a good OCT. And then, you know, it doesn't assess certain things such as hyperpermeability. Actually, you can talk about it from a uveitis perspective, a little bit, how useful or not useful it could be. Before, one of the issues was reimbursement, but there is a code now for OCTA. So that's not the biggest issue. But then workflow. A lot of people in the past complained about workflow because the acquisition time was longer. How do you fit it into your standard workflow? I think over time, that's a problem that has become less and less of an issue as people have become more and more comfortable seeing the benefits of the technology. Akshay, I'll let you kick it off. You do retina, you do uveitis. How much OCTA do you use? If you don't use it, why don't you use it? Do you think it's an adequate substitute for your uveitis patients, for example, for to go into OCTA instead of an FA?
So all the questions. So the short answer is I don't use OCT a ton. I use it virtually not at all for retina patients. And I use it in select uveitis patients. So in uveitis patients, you know, you'll see pictures of patients with like a multifocal choroiditis with a PED, and you're wondering if that's a CMV. And there are these nice pictures showing a little CMV. But as we know, the OCTA, I feel like you can see what you want to see. You can convince yourself there's a CMV where there may or not in fact be one. So even in that situation, it's not great. I think the one place I really use it quite a bit is in patients with like occlusive vasculitis, where you're seeing progressive vascular pruning really at a capillary level, and it's already kind of in the macula, and you're really trying to assess, you know, whether you're treating them adequately. Doing a fluorescein every time is terrible, and you actually honestly do not get the resolution you need. So in a case like that, an OCT I think is indispensable to actually see if you're dropping even little bits of capillary very non-invasively. So I love having it for those patients, but that's honestly about the extent that I use it. If we had a way to just do a massive wide field, you know, OCTA, it might replace doing an ICG to kind of assess those kind of deeper layers. But in the absence of that, it's not even a substitute for an ICG in my hands.
Yeah, Sarwar. What about you? Your solo practice, do you do OCTA? Does it fit into your workflow?
Yeah, honestly, I think it takes effort to fit into the workflow because, you know, as we talked about, it takes a little bit longer. I don't get this imaging standard, but if I know that I'm suspicious, I mean, especially in patients with like even mild to moderate NPDR, you can really see in the deep capillary plexus some of the loss in patients who may have sort of an otherwise relatively silent appearing fundus. I like showing patients the regression of the neovascular vessels. I mean, I have a few like weird uveitis patients with macular neovascular lesions. And you really, and you know, sometimes it's inflammatory, is it a vascular component? It's often both. to demonstrate that to patients before and after anti-VEGF has been helpful. Where I find it most helpful actually is, and I do a lot of fluorescein and just because I find it super helpful for the permeability issue. But I think for subclinical CNV, where you have these big PEDs where they look not just serous or not just drusenoid, but they look complex, in order to demonstrate some vascularity in them to see if there's true flow in them, because sometimes it may look like it, but there may not be flow. I tend to follow those patients a bit more closely. So instead of bringing them back and, with the PED in like, 3 to 4 months, I'll bring them back in like, I don't know, like 4 to 6 weeks, just at least initially, to see if there's any activity that pops up. So I find it helpful for that because honestly, in subclinical CNV, and the big thing is it depends on the fluorescein angiography technology that you have. I have an Optos fluorescein angiography. So the macular pathology with, especially for AMD, I think it's very subpar, unless you have like one of the, like especially like the Heidelberg or some of these better cameras that better capture the posterior pole. The Optos fluorescein angiography for macular stuff is not helpful. So in that situation, I like having the OCTA as an adjunct.
Yeah, and I think we don't have it at our county hospital. I think mostly just for leanness, but I think of these scenarios like you guys referenced where it would be very, very helpful. And I think it's good that we have a code. I mean, I think that our generation, again, I think it's generational. I think like the generation coming up is going to be like, I need it. Our generation's like, I want it, and the generation in front of us is like, I don't need to have it, and the generation ahead of that is like, I really don't want it. Get it out of my sight. And I don't think that's purely true. But I joked about how like we've been talking about this for a lot. This is just a great example of how it takes time. It takes time and infrastructure and for things to make sense. Like the technology has to get to a point where it's useful. The wide field part is, I would say, the most useful technological aspect that's getting added. The second is there has to be some sort of financial incentive realistically for it to happen. And third, people have to get used to incorporating into their workflow so it becomes something they're used to, not something they're choosing to do. And in that vein, let's jump into something more on the patient side, which are wearables. And I think this is something we've talked about previously too, but the technology is really, really changing quite quickly. And this is tracking retina health with wearable technology by Raj Kundu and Sharon Fekret, who's one of your mentors, Akshay. And one of the interesting things that I think the most interesting line I'll summarize is they say that wearable medical device industry is worth over $100 billion in 2025. Is projected to grow over 300 billion by 2032. I would assume that includes like insulin, CGMs. I'm assuming that includes Apple Watches, Oura Rings, anything people are wearing to track their health, Fitbits, right? But they talk about monitoring retinal health and they talk about VR-based perimetry for more intuitive visual field testing. I think we've all seen that visual fields can be very frustrating for certain patients and for certain people who are technicians conducting them. They talk about wearable fundus imaging. This has been done at Johns Hopkins, and essentially it would be a device that you just put on your eyes that takes a picture of your fundus, which is a cool idea. If it's successful, it's still not fully developed, but then that gets translated into wearable OCT. And Dr. Fekret and a lot of people do have a lot of interest in sort of doing OCT imaging in better ways. And this would be a step beyond OCTA. No workflow issues, Sarwar. You would just hand them the wearable in your waiting room while their AI is filling out their paperwork for you. Maybe you already have it. It literally just put this on, get a vision, pressure, OCT, whatever. This is OCT only. And then it captures what you need. And then they say, if you could do this in all patients, right, you'd probably capture a lot more information about connections to systemic disease. That's something Dr. Fekret has had a lot of interest in research in, for example, with Alzheimer's, in terms of using OCT data and OCT data. Well, there might be other sort of things you could get if you get broader sort of databases of OCT for patients. And then for systemic sort of monitoring. Now, the systemic monitoring, some of it is beyond us. They talk about CGMs with smartphones. They talk about hypertensive monitoring, but then IOP monitoring is the one I'll mention, soft contact lenses that could measure IOP. And instead of getting individual IOP measurements, which I don't think bothers us very much, we get continuous IOP measurements, which would really make our glaucoma colleagues and their patients very, very happy. Actually, a lot of these seem like a pipe dream, but I think every technology seems like a pipe dream. Everything seems feasible to some degree with the barriers we just talked about in terms of You got to get people used to using it. You got to get it to be cost effective. You got to get it to be adopted. And you got to be have enough bandwidth financially to have patience to give people 5 or 10 years to wrap their heads around something and use it. Which of these makes you the most excited?
To be honest, the augmented reality for our patients with GA, in part because like it's interesting because I feel like we've been hearing about various types of glasses like these for years. And I'll have a patient that'll randomly come in and say like, "Hey, I was able to get those through my low vision at my VA, and I love it." And I'm like, "How do I get that?" And I have absolutely no idea how to get it, right? I'll send them to low vision specialists in the community. They have not even heard of it. So the augmented reality glasses where you're kind of mapping someone's scotoma and then projecting image, onto a healthy retina to their eccentric vision, seeing it makes sense and seems reasonable. And I think the patients that I've seen that actually feel like they're seeing something, it's just a question again of like how do we get that covered and where do we get that from, right? There's so many different companies and so many different glasses. I don't think like we as retina doctors truly know. I know there's a couple of people that are actually involved in this, and perhaps they know better than we do, but I don't think this is something that we widely talk about, honestly.
Sarwar, skeptical?
I agree. No, I mean, I think this is exciting, right? Because, for patients who've had severe central vision loss, to be able to offer them something is nice. I mean, a lot of times it's like, oh yeah, go to low vision, go to the lighthouse. And it's sort of like, it's sad that that's what it comes to sometimes. But I think the augmented reality component is very, very exciting. I mean, in full transparency, I am an investor in Eidaptic. It was started by a friend of all of ours, and I think they're a great company. But irrespective of that, I mean, I think this is cool because it's something we can offer our patients that we could not offer before. I think some of the challenges I think are, say we start offering some of these technologies in our office. I mean, it's always fun to talk about new technology, right? But the implementation is hard because some of this technology is not just like plug and play. It requires some investment on the part of technicians. I mean, to explain some of this technology to patients is, I mean, maybe for our generation as we get older, it'll be easier to pick up some of this technology, but it's not necessarily easy to say like, here's a your you know here are your glasses, you just put them on. And then it sends us a picture. It sends us a retinal selfie. I mean, so I would wonder, and I would want to know some solutions as to how to incorporate some of these technologies. How do we offer to them? Do we send them to specific centers where these are offered? Are there resources that allow busy retina clinics to create time to train our patients? So we're not just saying, here's a thing, this is for your scotoma. I'm doing something for you. See you in 3 months. So those are some of the challenges with any new technology.
Yeah, and technology is the theme of this issue. And again, we can continue to talk about wearables, but now we're talking about surgical wearables. We're talking about heads-up surgery, but tied into heads-up surgery is sort of the idea of the actual headpiece being worn by the surgeon, not just heads-up. But Sean Berkowitz and Kat Talcott wrote about 3D visualing systems. And again, heads-up is another thing. Like we've talked about heads-up before. It's not the first time that we've talked about it. For those who aren't in the know, they summarize that there are these 3D systems where you can either wear 3D glasses, or in the case of Bionics One, you wear actual kind of immersive glasses that allow for you to not sit at a traditional microscope. The advantages are potentially lower illumination, which may be healthier for the retina. You may be able, with the 3D system with a screen, to throw up other ancillary data. They talked about FA images, integrated OCT. Ergonomics may be better. There's been some studies showing that ergonomics may be better. I would argue they're better, but maybe different. It just maybe reducing sort of your continuous in one position to spreading it to a different position, because every position can be ergonomically good or bad depending how long you're in it. Education of value in terms of not only the videos, but also the team, staffing, those sort of things, having the same view. And then they finally end by talking about limitations, right? Cost is a limitation. I think positioning, latency was an issue. I think saturation, peripheral visualization, which we can talk about. And they're talking again in the future. Intraop OCT has been integrated a little bit, but has not been really, really well integrated. I think we've all seen models at meetings, but realistically, I don't think it's like you see a bunch of surgeons right now operating, looking at their 3D image of the OCT while they're peeling, for example, to know where you grab. I mean, that's sort of something people have talked about, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong. I haven't really seen successful kind of implementation case to case to case of someone doing that. Sorry, I'll let you kick it off. Beyond your comment that Bionics should get Beyonce as a potential sponsor, I'm sure they're listening and we'll take that into account.
Yeah, well, I definitely want some
Hopefully,
credit
it
for
doesn't get
that.
them sued for like copyright for being so close to her name.
I'll leave Jay-Z to handle that. Honestly, this technology is cool, right?
I'm gonna zag and say I think technology is cool, and I think we've been talking about adoption, and adoption takes time. Heads Up has been around for a decade. The adoption is very slow. I would say it's much slower than OCTA. Not to be cynical, some of it's probably tied to the fact that you don't bill more. But I also think that one of the other big limitations is it costs a lot. And the cost price point of getting Heads Up is much higher than with, I think the turnover for surgical retina in terms of equipment is lower than the turnover for medical retina equipment. And I would count OCT and OCTA as medical retina equipment, partly because of the dynamics of offices, partly because the equipment needs to be. I feel like medical retina equipment is like computers. Like you can't really have devices for too long if you have to replace them. And then the OCTA comes in as an add-on, as a software add-on, right? Heads Up is totally different. Heads Up is requiring places to invest significant money and get rid of a functional microscope. So that really slows down the turnover when these microscopes last for a long time. Sarwar, when do you feel, do you think we'll ever reach a point where more than half or a majority of retinal surgeons will be using Heads Up surgery?
I think it would be really awesome. As retina specialists, we love technology, right? I mean, we love every, new iteration of technology that we have. But just like anything in the American healthcare system, everything is limited by the economics of healthcare. The reason I've tried the heads-up display, but why have I not used it? Because surgery centers and hospitals are not going to invest in something that does not increase the efficiency. Or, like for example, we can say, hey, this new, whatever, not even talk about heads-up display, like, oh, this new machine has a 30,000 cut per minute and, gives you warnings when you're like about to ding the retina. Like honestly, to be honest, I don't think the economics of healthcare take into account safety and things that make the surgeon's experience better. If it's actually reducing, the surgical time and increasing surgical efficiency so the surgeries are done better, so that more surgeries are done, unless there's an increase in the reimbursement, I don't see a lot of this technology becoming mainstream. And I hope the universe proves this wrong, because this is, I mean, if this is technology that truly helps us do our job better, it would be great for patients, it'd be great for us. But unfortunately, the surgical codes are being cut, and it doesn't really benefit surgery centers. So I mean, I've asked surgery centers, hey, can you get this thing for me? It's like, oh, it's not really. We have this other thing that kind of works. We have a microscope that works, So I think the economics of healthcare, I mean, it's cool to get excited about all this stuff, but I guess I'm a little bit jaded when we actually think of the implementation of new technology. And I'll say one more thing, what you mentioned about the peripheral visualization. I think that's really important, whenever we have this new technology, because, we deal with this every day. Like, there's all these new IOLs that are going into patients' eyes, and like these multifocal IOLs. I'm not talking about the ring ones, I'm talking about the depth of focus ones that, in my experience, instead of having image jump, have more image displacement. And it's really hard when you're doing tough TRDs and macular work. But, and that's something that we're putting into the eye. So this is something that I hope is accounted for. And maybe it already is. I just haven't used the technology yet.
Akshay, what do you think?
I agree. I think the question is, what problem are we solving for, right? And at the moment, there's not a huge problem that we're solving for with the heads-up display. I would argue, I agree, it's really great as a teaching tool because you can kind of point at things very easily, which is a little bit harder to do under an operating scope for such a small organ. But I would say, having operated with Cindy Toth, and obviously Justice Ehlers has done a lot of work on this, I think as we hopefully trend towards integrating a lot more information into our surgeries, there's a limited viewing space, right, through an operating scope. So if we trend towards where it's standard of care to have tons of imaging overlaid into our cases, you might have to do that. If we are showing some form of superior outcomes doing so, then that would be the situation in which I would see the trend. And maybe we find, as we start developing new types of surgeries, right? If we're starting to, place, chips on retinas and RP grafts under retinas, which shows some far superior outcomes, we might find ourselves, doing that more often. But with the current surgical armamentarium we have, I don't see a superiority yet.
Yeah, I think I love that thing you said. What problem are you solving? And I think most of our surgeries are anatomically successful. Let's say it that way. There's still a lot of work to be done in retina in terms of visual outcomes, but compared to like 30 years ago, we're obviously blessed that like most retinal detachments are fixed at the end of the surgery. They should be. Most macular holes close with surgery. Most epiretinal membranes, if not all, are removed during the surgery. I think the question then is the soft stuff, like because which is muddy and hard to like identify, which is like, well, would your reattachments have gone quicker with this thing? Would you have caused less trauma when peeling? I think that's been very hard for people to quantify, which is why there's been fixation on the light illumination thing. I believe the light illumination thing, but the thing reason we keep hearing about it, because it's something very easy to quantify and put a p-value to. And I think the other stuff is much harder because visual outcomes are so variable in retina. There's so much other noise in surgical studies that it's probably very difficult to ever show a difference. Because it gets washed out because there's so many other patient factors that probably outweigh what you did during the procedure and which imaging system you used, right? But to your point, Akshay, if it's like I have to make a 4 millimeter slit in the retina and slide this thing in, and if I slide it properly, if it becomes binary, where like if I do this thing properly, they do great. If I don't do this thing properly, they do terribly, then it becomes a lot easier to justify. We'll have to wait and see. The problem again there is like, is it going to be something on large enough numbers you can still quantify and show somebody? And ultimately, the Star Wars showing your surgery center and going to them and being like, hey, I have this data showing that we need to get this amazing heads-up display, not just because I'm Star Wars and I think this is cool because I'm a surgeon, but because it changes outcomes for my patients, right? That's ultimately, you're not, unless you plan to fund it yourself, Star Wars, someone else is going to be making that purchasing decision. Sorry, you look depressed about that thought. One day you'll
One
buy
day,
your own.
guys.
You'll just have one at home just to mess around with. Last thing, not technology based, but Akshay is here. We got to throw him a bone. Plus, this is actually one of my closet favorite topics because it was like the first retina paper I ever wrote was on this topic. Is endogenous fungal endophthalmitis. I don't know how this ended up in the new technology, but I love it because it's such a cool. I think it's a very interesting disease. Aarti Venkat and Eleanor Burden wrote this. And they just summarize how fungal endophthalmitis accounts for about half of all endogenous endophthalmitis. It's only about 5 to 10% of all endophthalmitis cases. And you know, they identify risk factors, IV drug use, immunosuppression, malignancy. They talk about the need for systemic therapy and source, looking for a source. They talk about what sort of medications should be used. Bioavailability, especially superior for fluconazole and voriconazole, and then get into their single institution study to look at oral versus IV therapy. And essentially, what they showed is what every endogenous fungal endophthalmitis showed is that, again, it's very variable. There's a ton of variation in treatment strategies. There is no definitive evidence that IV is better than oral. And about a third of these patients, they said only 30%, but I think it's impressive. I think a third of these patients go to surgery. I think that I would actually say that is very useful. And I tell these patients that it's somewhere in my mind between 25 to 33% of these patients end up benefiting from surgery, Akshay, but love to hear your thoughts on it. Akshay, I think this is a super interesting disease because it's one of those things where if you see it, you know what it is, which is great in ophthalmology. It's one of the things we attract us to the field, but it's also one of those things that people forget about on the differential for weird cases. And we had one recently who I operated on where there was no view and ended up being fungal endophthalmitis. It's extremely difficult to prove because fungus is tough to grow. You end up driving your ID and medicine crazy because you tell them, no, they have to have a systemic source. And they're like, I can't find anything. You're like, look harder. It's there. You just need to keep looking. And it's extraordinarily challenging to treat. Fungus is hard to get rid of. It's not as simple. Bacterial endophthalmitis is not easy, but at least you achieve sterility very quickly when you treat bacterial endophthalmitis. That is not for most bacterial endophthalmitis. That is not true, for example, for Canada. It takes a long time to get mold or yeast to die. Any thoughts or comments on this and these types of patients?
Yeah, what's great about uveitis is we can say, in my experience, and that carries about as much weight as anything because we all have a couple patients. But a couple things, just again, these are strictly observational and in my experience type of things. I think one thing when we're kind of attacking fungus, kind of regardless of what it is, in my experience, is kind of where it is. And so if you have a patient that has really like a fungal chorioretinitis, those patients tend to actually do pretty darn well with oral medications because you're getting lots of choroidal, perfusion, we'll say, with that systemic antifungal, and you can treat the retinal component with intravitreal. Even kind of mid-vitreous, fungus can do pretty well with intravitreal agents. But in my experience, when you have, any amount of lens seeding,
Yes, that's what I was gonna say.
Yeah, you'll see those melt, when you put in some intracameral, intravitreal antifungals, and they come right back. And I have literally injected people for, 9 to 12 months before I've said, okay, sorry, your eye's 20/20, but I just got to get this lens out of the eye.
Yeah.
And that's finally what they need. The one other pearl, which I kind of, got from one of my ID doctors is, we typically, if you're using fluconazole, right, standard dosing, 200 milligrams once a day, you can really go up to 800 milligrams once a day with careful renal monitoring. And in the two patients that had persistent disease despite removing their IOLs that had angle seating, that's what finally got them off intravitreal agents. So again, not a one size fits all, very challenging,
Yes.
very often a surgical disease, but you got to get to know that you can throw multiple things at it.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing. I was going to say one of the tip offs that someone may have fungal is if you see someone like I call it the mystery box uveitis, where you don't have a view and you're just B scanning them. When you see a lot of collected inflammation right behind the crystalline lens, or it could be an IOL, but they're phakic, let's say, that makes me start thinking about fungal. There's very few things that sort of collect on the back of the capsule like that on B scan. And like you said, that's been my experience too, is inevitably you're better off getting rid of the capsule and suturing a lens if you get a best case win, which is what happened with the patient we took care of. Is, we waited 3, 4 months, put oil in, took the oil out, and sutured in the lens. Oil is a little controversial in these patients if you do take them to surgery. I like oil if you can get a good enough view to do the exchange, because I think it's at least fungostatic, if not fun. I don't think it's fungicidal, but it's at least fungostatic. I think the other thing that comes up is you may have to tell these patients and their doctors, if they're trying to treat with mycofungin, like systemically, or something that's not vori or fluconazole, like you're saying, that's where it's useful to do the screening and say, hey, we don't have to inject. This is a peripheral lesion. They have candidemia, but maybe you want to change to something that covers, penetrates a little better in case, there is some retinal involvement. Sarwar, I'm just going to ask you about screening. Do you take hospital call at this point?
I do. I
What do you think
do.
about screening? This is like a hot topic.
I mean, we all did call for like it's like a reflex. Oh, someone has candidemia, check the retina. But I think, there have been some studies that have shown that in patients who are able to communicate, symptoms are like the highest positive predictive value of a positive retinal exam. So I try to, educate our referring doctors about that, but it's hard to be like, if they're expecting if someone's expecting a patient to be seen, it's hard to sort of push back against that. But in anybody that has very is unable to sort of like voice symptoms, I think it's very, especially like intubated, sedated patients, it's important to take a look. And I think just pearls for all of us is just to keep it on our differential. I mean, for any uveitis, and honestly, sometimes I if I have a uveitis of unknown etiology, in addition to doing empiric Bactrim and sometimes empiric Valtrex, like there, it's not a bad idea to pop in some empiric voriconazole PO. If insurance coverage can be very challenging for voriconazole in my experience, but it's something to always keep in the back of our mind. And I agree with both of you. I think going to surgery, especially instead of like babysitting these lesions that sometimes just won't go away, is the best move.
Yeah, the other thing I'll say is two other things. The RD rate for fungal endophthalmitis has been reported higher than bacterial. I'd love to know if you think that's true from a uveitis perspective. And then the second thing is, I'm with you on empiric therapy, Sarwar. I'm actually, and again, this might just be my bias from where I trained. I'm not a big systemic antifungal empiric person for a lesion, just because I don't think being on it a day or two earlier systemically may change the final outcome. I am a fan every once in a while. I hate doing this, but I remember doing this once as a fellow, Akshay, which is you throw everything. You literally throw the kitchen sink intravitreally.
It's like a soup of all the stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, you give them some vori, you give some foscarnet or ganciclovir. I'm also not the biggest fan of that unless you're really worried about the vision, but that would get you to steady state levels a little faster. But anyway, Akshay, any comments on the RD risk?
Yeah, I mean, the one last thing I was going to say, and this kind of boils into RD, is it's really important if you take these patients to surgery, going back to imaging, is if you can get an OCT through any type of fungal lesion to kind of look in where it is, because there's lots of times you'll think these lesions are pre-retinal, and especially as you're lifting hyoid, you're like, yeah, I'm gonna lift that lesion, it's gonna pop right off. It come to find it's actually intraretinal or chorioretinal, and you go putz around with it, and that's part of how people get detachments, because if they have these peripheral lesions, this is what I'm gonna say, and lesson learned. I've had patients that have had peripheral intraretinal lesions, and I'm like, hey, I'm just gonna Get the vitreous off of that, put in some antifungal, leave it alone. Then they contract and they get slit tears at the edges of it. So nowadays, if I have a peripheral lesion, I might barricade around it, sparing like a decent amount of space away from it, understanding that's probably going to contract and it could develop a slit tear and a break.
That's a great pearl. And I would say, like, if you can't get the vitreous plug out, don't force it. Just segment it if it's posterior, because sometimes that plug is directly down, like you're saying. That plug is vitreous through retina down to the choroid. If it's really that tight where you couldn't get it off, just trim it down, get it so it's no traction on it, barricade it. Because if you pull hard enough on any plug, you will unplug it. And there was something on the other side, which is usually bare choroid and bleeding. So anyway, that was a great sort of a segue from technology. Let's talk about fungal endophthalmitis. I really appreciate you guys taking the time, kicking off the new year with me. Akshay Thomas, Sarwar Zahid, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Jay.
Happy New Year, guys.
Thanks again to Drs. Thomas and Zahid for joining for this episode. Thanks to our whole production team, including Justin Zhang, Dr. Justin Mon, Dr. Louis Kai. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, for what you do in 2026 and beyond to contribute to our field and the conversations you inspire here. Remember, all 489 episodes can be found online on our website, retinapodcast.com. You can always reach out to me directly by emailing at retinapodcast@gmail.com or by clicking on the Contact Us link on our website. Hope to see you back next week. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.